Well, good afternoon, everybody. We're back after whatever interrupted us and that weird recording. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk, James and I, and we'll post this recording later and the podcast. Anyway, what a pleasure it is to chat with you again about Des Limerick, whom, let me say again, I have described as a British Jack. I love this. Jack Reacher is the quintessential American guy written by a Brit. Des Limerick is a British guy, a British Jack Reacher, written by an American in Portland. So I'm not too sure how that works. But anyway, Des is wonderful. He's way more likely to have personal attachments. And he's quite funny. So, yep. So even if you had Jack in mind, you also decided that Des would be his own man and be different, didn't you?
Very much so, yeah. There are so many great writers in the genre of single male action protagonists. I read them all and I love them all. I love Lee Child. I love Greg Hurwitz. I love Meg Gardner. I love, it goes on and on and on. They're all terrific. But if I wanted to do this sort of book, I needed to have something that nobody else had. And so I thought and thought and thought and finally came up with the notion of having a guy with no angst. He has no grudge against the world. He's not unhappy. He considers himself to be the luckiest son of a gun on the planet. Wandering around the States with a guitar on his back, just having a lot of fun. And when he stumbles into trouble, it's, well, these things happen. And so writing a guy who is genuinely in a good mood all the time just seemed like that voice I hadn't seen before.
Well, I think that's an excellent way to describe this, but let us not forget, by the way, before we go any further, we do have autographed copies signed for you by the author at the Poison Pen, as we did, in fact, last year for The Gatekeeper, which introduced us to Des. And excuse me, when we talk about him being a gatekeeper, he has some really interesting skills honed in his military life. So why don't you explain that? Because, I mean, he can survive. The one thing we never really worry about, well, we don't worry about that with Reacher either. But anyway, what we don't worry about is no matter how dire the situation is, we know that Des is up to the task.
I needed to find an angle that I hadn't seen before, and I finally came up with this notion of, in the real military world, he'd be called a breach expert. I use the term gatekeeper. He's the guy that opens the door for his military unit. Keep it open as long as it needs to be and decide who does and does not get through. Now, it seemed like it lent itself to a whole bunch of fun stories, especially depending on how you define door, because like a password and a web address is a door and a key of sorts. And so he can open any doors. We can open those too. So that notion that he is the breach expert, he's the guy who gets people in and keeps people out, just seemed like a really lovely bit of business that I hadn't seen. I wanted to try it.
No, I think it works well. Actually, I was laughing when I read Mark Greeny's Instagram post about taking his family of eight to Europe. And he said, the trip was a success. I took eight people and I brought eight people home. And it reminded me slightly of Des in that respect that, that's really his job is, as you say, not to just let people in, but also to bring them out. Right. So he is ex-military. So he has to have some sort of income to allow him to sort of wander around the United States, or it's not necessarily the case that he's going to stay in the United States. But when we met him in The Gatekeeper, he was in Southern California, which was required for that plot to work. And now he's gone to Portland, which, no surprise, is the home of our author here. So much of this book is wonderful about Portland. And I have to say that Portland is a city in something of a crisis, isn't it? It doesn't really come up in your book, but Portland's having a hard time.
I really, really wanted to set a book in Portland. I hadn't done it in a very long time because it's my hometown. It's the town I love beyond words. It's just, I wouldn't live anywhere else. One of the greatest cities on earth. And yes, it's had a rough run with the pandemic and we had the Black Lives Matter protests for many months. And then we had wildfires that were literally on the edge of the urban area. And we had the homelessness crisis. And now we've got the fentanyl crisis. And so for sure, the city's taken quite a beating, as have most major cities in America. My thing is that Portland is bouncing back. Portland is a resilient town. It's a town. It's a small town, cleverly disguised as a city. It's filled with people who have a can-do attitude. And I work for a newspaper in Portland, Oregon. And we've been telling people, do not count Portland out. She's a little bit beat up right now, but she's bouncing back.
Well, it'd be, you know, interesting to see some of the experiments in defunding the police and decriminalizing hard drugs and other things have had consequences. San Francisco, it looks to me, is pretty much, you know, a hopeless case at the moment. Phoenix has had, not Scottsdale, but Phoenix has had considerable difficulty with the homeless camp. And honestly, I keep thinking with this weather, how is anyone really surviving?
Me too.
If my Saguaro can't survive and, you know, it's dropped a limb, I can't even imagine how people are out there. But, and it's not just a U.S. crisis. I've talked to some Canadians about it. My last visit to Toronto, it was clear that there was a serious homeless problem in Toronto. So as a crime writer, and you're trying to deal with, you know, your scenario in Portland, do you decide to embrace this vision of Portland and what's going on, or do you write around it?
Yeah. In this instance, I decided this book is with, you know, God willing, this book will be on the shelf for many, many years to come. And so I wasn't going to paint one specific period of time. And instead, I was going to look at the eyes of this city that I love, that I've been here since college, through the eyes of somebody who hadn't seen it before. And I had a lot of fun reminding myself of the things that about Portland that I absolutely love. My wife and I live downtown. Today, I wandered over to Powell's bookstore for launch day. It's my neighborhood bookstore. It's a great place. So yes, got some troubles for sure, as do many, many major cities in the West. But I wanted to paint the Portland I know and the Portland that lives here. And I was hoping I got to that in this book.
Oh, I think you did. And not just Portland, but, you know, the area around it. It's a particularly beautiful place. You know, you can, the mountain that kind of, you know, the volcano that dominates the skyline when you're there. You know, the Rose Garden is extraordinary. We took off on our Snake River cruise from Portland. And in order to do that, I carefully picked the 4th of July as actually the 5th of July is the sailing date, so that we can spend the 4th of July in Portland, which has a truly, like Boston, remarkable 4th of July fireworks display. I think it's on an island, isn't it?
It's on barges.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay, so it's the river is a key part of the whole thing.
Absolutely, and it's gorgeous. It's amazing.
It is, right. So anyway, why is Des summoned to Portland? Because we have left him in Southern California, where he has a female attachment that occurred in The Gatekeeper. But it never was going to be permanent, was it? We knew when it was going on that it was going to be, it was going to come to an end as both of them moved on with their lives in different directions.
As the song says, it was a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, but it was just one of those things. And so that relationship was not going to be part of it. In this one, he has a friend who's a singer-songwriter. She calls him from Portland and says, my sister's in trouble. She was mugged. She's in the hospital. She was mugged twice. Des being Des, he says, I'm on the next plane north, flies up here to see if he can help her. Gets involved with a story that involves the Witness Protection Program, U.S. Marshal Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and a fictional major Northwest high-tech corporation that I invented for the purpose of this story. And so, yes, I get to spend lots of time with my character throughout Oregon as well as in Portland. And that was a lot of fun. It's a fun little story to tell.
Why did you decide to call your tech company what you did? It's a great name.
I have this very strange little brain. I will find a word and tuck it away in a little filing cabinet inside my skull for a long, long period of time. And years and years and years ago, I mean, maybe when I was in my 30s, I saw the word clock jack. And a clock jack is the device that was used in the fireplace of a medieval castle to turn a big old roast or a pig or whatever.
Oh, it was like a dog spit, except it worked with the clock.
Right. And it had gears on the outside. And it was called a clock jack. And I remember thinking, that's a great word. I'm going to tuck that in my weird little filing cabinet of fun words. And somewhere down the line, I'll find a way to use it. And boy, that was just decades ago. And I finally thought, oh, I got one. I know how to use it.
Clock jack. I love that. I've actually been in Bath, England, been to the National Trust House at the end of the Royal Crescent. And they're often very proud of their kitchens in National Trust homes, which are relics of the past. And in that one, they have a dog spit, which means that it was an unfortunate canine that had to walk around and rotate the spits that were turning to meat. But I suppose it was inevitable that somebody would automate that, right? An early robot replacement of a live working
exactly. animal
and use the gears. It makes perfectly good sense. The gears from clock mm-hmm. to, in fact, you know, rotate the spit. I love that. But I for some reason, I never heard that word.
It just was one of those words that resonated with me, and I was glad I got to finally use it.
You did, right. So high-tech company, no surprise in Portland. Tell us about Razia, because she's a really interesting character, and music is a part, her music, she's very talented, is part of the background, the fabric of this story.
Well, there are two sisters. There's the one who's the musician, and Des has backed her up as a professional, both on piano and guitar and bass. And then her sister is a journalist up here. She's a business writer. And it was sort of fun. I often have, as you know, a really strong female protagonists. There was a bunch of them in the first book, Petra, amongst others. But I tend to make my strong female protagonists 40 and older. And I thought it would be fun to do two people who have a lot of strength in what they do and who are still in their mid-20s, because I just hadn't written that before. So neither of them are fighters. Neither of them are going to be in the thick of the battle. But in what they do, they're very, very skilled and gifted. And they start the book far apart, as sometimes sisters are in their 20s, and they draw closer together through the upheaval of this book. So it was sort of fun writing a very younger, strong, two younger, stronger female characters, just to see how that dynamic would play out. And that was fun. I enjoyed that.
So Des got to meet Razia through the music, right?
Right. Yes. He'd been backing her up when they were in LA and a couple of other places. And then when the going got hot in the first book, he said, maybe you ought to go find some place to hide out because I have some bad guys looking for me. She went up to Portland. And so the last scene of the first book and the first scene, you discount the prologue of the second book, are seconds apart. So that story's done. He gets a phone call from her, launches the next one, which I'm hoping will be my laddering system for the, you know, the second book and third book begins right off it. So that's the mechanism I'm hoping to use.
I like that. You know, there isn't any reason for them to age in real time. And in fact, if you're going to have an action figure like this, aging them in real time is sort of oxymoronic, because there's only so many years when anybody is at their peak physically. And Des does do a lot of physical action in his role here as the gatekeeper.
Elvis Cole and Joe Pike were being badass guys in 1987, if my memory serves,
the first time I created
one of those. So I think I'm in safe grounds not having Des age too much.
Yeah, well, the monkey's raincoat. Well, look at Spencer. I mean, he was a Korean War veteran when it all started.
That's right.
You know, Michael with Harry Bosch, though, you know, Harry is a Vietnam veteran, but Michael has aged him. To the point where he has brought in younger characters, because Harry can't really do that. Nevada Bar had a wonderful series, many of you remember, with Anna Pigeon, who was a national park ranger. And the genius of that series is she moved from park to park. So we got to tour all the national parks. But Nevada retired her because she did age her. And she said that it was incredible for Anna, over 50, to be doing the kinds of physical, the kinds of physical exertion, or, you know, whatever it was that had made the earlier books so interesting. She couldn't really imagine her doing that. And
that was a great series.
It was a wonderful series. It really was. It had that same brilliance that Reacher has, in that the character would remain the same, but the location would constantly shift. And so the center of the series held, but you were in a new community and a new thing every single time. And readers love that, you know, you didn't lose the core characters, but you always got a new landscape, which is a lot different than, you know, something like the Cabot Cove thing or series that are rooted in one particular place. I mean, Los Angeles, you know, Bob Graves can get away with it because Los Angeles is myriad communities. And, you know, you could sort of like travel the world and still stay in Los Angeles, which in fact was partially true in The Gatekeeper, you know, various angles of it, Southern California, if not Los Angeles. But that would be difficult to do if you stayed in Portland.
Right. You know?
So And I'm gathering from this conversation that Des is not going to stay in Portland, but don't tell me. I want to be surprised, but probably he will move on having, you know, it's that Shane, it's that wonderful Western thing. The guy comes to town, you know, cleans up the town, rides away, right?
Yes. And that a lot of people didn't understand. That's why Lee Child was such a genius, is he was writing Westerns. The hero would ride into town.
Absolutely.
Problem, and then ride into the sunset and not get to stay and benefit from the goodness that he had recreated. And it was very much the structure of a Western, and it just happened to be set in the 2000s. But that was part of Lee's total genius, and why I think those books work like money in the bank, like clockwork. Those books are all rock solid.
Well, and you know, you get to see different parts of it. So far, he stayed within the United States. But, you know, you get to tour all over the country. And since Reacher, you know, he's got nothing basically with him. He just gets on the bus and goes. So it's classic Shane. Rides into town on the bus, romances the girl, sometimes not, you know, forms some alliances, cleans up the town, and then steps on the bus. And you see little Brandon Wilde back there going, Shane, you know, it
right.
Doesn't work that way. And also they can start sequentially, you know, as soon as he gets back on the bus and rides, the next adventure awaits without months going by, right? Although sometimes there's a time lapse. So it's great that he, you know, kind of created this paradigm or whatever it is, but have fun to vary it.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah. I'm having a lot of fun. I told you I wouldn't tell you, but I will tell you, Des actually does go to another place in the third book. And so it's been fun to re-see the United States through the eyes of a foreigner. And
Are you going to keep him in the United States? He is British after all.
No, in the next book, he spends part of the time back in England and connects with some of his mates there, and then heads to the Washington, D.C. area for the latter half of the book.
Okay. I mean, he could really travel the world. Well, you know, and I think that makes it interesting, too, is you never know for sure where he's going to end up next. But anyway, back to my original question, does he get some sort of a pension? I mean, he has to have something to live on.
A couple of things. One is he has been, and while he's in Los Angeles in the first book, he's doing some small engine repairs with a friend of his who owns a garage, and he's playing these gigs. In theory, yeah. He's paid. So he's making a little bit of money, but I'd make references, veiled references in the second book, that he's got some money tucked away, and possibly it's not money he's supposed to have.
Okay. Possible seed for a future story.
Yes. And there is a antagonistic character in this book, and at one point Des finds that he's getting a little bit low on resources and simply taps into her money, and so taps into is a polite way of saying steals. And once again, because he's good with
I love it. Well, yeah. he requires sort of minimal maintenance, you know. Right. He's not a guy that is high maintenance kind of a character, so indeed you could do that, but still everybody has to have, you know, like basic eating money and right. So forth. Right. Now, I would have thought that Clockjack presented him with an opportunity to acquire more serious funds, but we won't go into that. So why'd you decide to have a tech company in here? You could have had any number of operations that were at work in Portland. What interested you about, well, tell us what Clockjack is, actually.
So 40 years ago, four friends who were professors at Portland State University came up with the notion of a thing they thought they could do, totally fictional, of course, in which they can monitor the ebbs and flows of government spending, and then you pay your taxes whenever the thing that you care about is most getting funded and the thing you care about least isn't. So if you are a typical Portland greenie and you don't want your money to go into the Defense Department, this logarithm they've created will let you say the Defense Department is only getting 95% of its funding right now, and the parks are getting 105. Now is a good time to pay from escrow some of your taxes. This is, of course, entirely fictional. I have no idea if it would really work. It probably wouldn't. But that was the origin of it. And from this one thing that caught on very big, they built this billion-dollar company that is all over the world, and have become famous. for the many, many, many things they do and for the green causes they represent. And part of that was in my first book, politically speaking, some of the bad guys were very, very conservative. And I thought it'd be really fun to introduce a company that is very, very green and liberal and typical of Portland. And you'll find the same rotten core in that group that you found in that other group, that the politics is not the important thing. It's the corruption that is.
Corrupts, you know, actually it wasn't I used to say it was Machiavelli, but it wasn't Machiavelli. Whoever it was right when he said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And part of the problem is, as we're seeing play out on the national stage all the time, is that you get surrounded by yes men and or people who only feed you information that you want to hear because they need to keep their jobs. And they also don't want you to get information from other sources because then their jobs might become obsolete. I've seen that rotate around celebrities. I mean, it isn't just politicians. And people with extraordinary wealth. I mean, who says no to Elon Musk? Clearly nobody. And, you know, there was a very sad article about, Tony Hsi, whatever his name was, the shoe guy, the Zappos guy, who ended up, you know, who ended up on tremendous drugs and then finally set fire to himself in a shed. And
Oh my God.
But he was another billionaire, and they said that part of the problem was as he went more and more off the rails. It reminds you of Howard Hughes, actually. He went more and more off the rails, there wasn't anyone who could, at that point, who could actually stop him, you know, could get through to him and or wasn't willing to risk whatever job or influence they had by trying to get through to him. So he came to this really tragic end. Have you really not read about that?
I did not know that story, no.
No, it was a big piece maybe last week in the New York Times or something, the Journal, but I remember when it happened. Anyway, you know, and you see an awful lot of, and there seem to be an extraordinary number of billionaires right now. I mean, where did they all come from? I often wonder. That's a lot of money.
It's an awful lot of money. It's an awful lot of money concentrated in the top 1% or perhaps the 1% of the 1%. Yeah. And it's a conversation perhaps for another day because we need a solution. I don't think anybody knows what it is.
Well, it reminds me of the run-up to the French Revolution, you know? I mean, and I can certainly understand. I don't sympathize with it, nor would I wish to enhance it, but I do understand the politics of resentment and, you know, that sort of anger when people have way too much. You only have to read the Mansion section every Friday, the Wall Street Journal, to recognize there are people with way too much money. And many people with not nearly enough. And the inequities of it are astronomical. But anyway, fact it is. So here he is in Portland and Clockjack, what's going on? What brings him into the sphere of Clockjack?
The element I had was that he runs into some bad guys, one of whom was being hunted by the Drug Enforcement Administration, one was being hunted by the U.S. Marshal Service. And Des being Des, he manages to subdue them both. And shortly after that, they both reappear. And he's beginning to realize that people who are in custody are slipping free of their bonds. And he suspects there's a technological reason why it's doing it. And lo and behold, it's all rotating around this company that he has stumbled into. So he begins to suspect that there's something that this company is doing that is allowing people who should be locked up or should be in the witness protection program to be elsewhere and nobody knows it. So that's what it goes from protecting these two young women from muggings to a much deeper plot that involves parts of Africa and the rest of the United States. And it grows exponentially from there.
It does. So let's talk about Razia's sister, because she's the one, the investigative journalist, that is the bridge to Clockjack.
I'm a journalist by training. I work for a newspaper. So it was sort of fun introducing a young newspaper person. You'll note that I'd make her a television person. Or, you know, my bias in journalism is really clear right there. So it was a lot of fun, and it was a lot of fun to dispel some cliches about journalism too. That when Des says, "What did you write that would make people so angry that they would, you know, try and kill you?" She says, "Nothing. I'm a business writer. I don't even crack the front page of the paper. My stories don't even make it on A1. Why would he?" And that, which is true of so many of us. I, that the things that we do are, you know, people peel potatoes into newspapers. We are a transitory industry. And so she is completely verklempt as to why anything she could have written has gotten people hunting for her. And that's kind of the way we feel about our work. We all feel it's quite ephemeral and transitory. And once you've written a story, it's out of your mind and you've moved on to the next. So that was sort of fun to play with that feeling.
Right. Well, what else can we say? I don't want to give away any spoilers. I mean, that's a great setup. Here's Des in Southern California with Petra, solve that problem, and the gatekeepers gets the phone call, comes to Portland. The sister is, you know, under jeopardy, so forth. And the next thing you know, he starts pulling. It's like, you know, the way he gets into things, it's like he starts pulling at threads, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And my absolutely brilliant editor at St. Martin's, Keith Kayla, in the first book, he wanted a prequel, or actually a prologue, I meant. And I thought, most editors I know tell me never to do prologues. You know, you start at the start of the story. You don't start before the start of the story. And he said, no, I think we need one. I think we need to know a little bit about Des in his pre-retirement. You know, he's 35 and retired, but we need to know him in that element a little bit before we see him in action as a civilian. So I introduced a prologue in this book, and I got to introduce a spy, a British spy, who then she comes in later in the book and becomes a critical factor. But thanks to the genius that is Keith, we had established her and her skill sets in that prologue as well. So when she shows up, we know what she's capable of. And then she's in book three, which is in Keith's hands now and getting edited. So although I think you can read the books in any order, I do introduce characters in one book and use them as the springboard for my plot in the next book. And Arabella Sati is one of those characters who is going to helps me get out of act three in this book, but she also is pivotal in the next book.
So actually you open the book by saying Desmond Aloysius, I've learned to pronounce that, Aloysius Limerick, has been ordered to fly into Baku, Azerbaijan under a false name, carrying nothing but a change of clothes and a paperback Michel Bussy novel in the original French. He is met by a woman he knows to be a British agent, MI6. She's Pakistani and English. I love that. I mean, yeah, it's a great setup. You're right. Your editor is a genius. I've known him for forever. And he's wonderful. And he also really likes his authors to do well.
Yes, he does.
Yes. And he's a very loyal kind of a guy.
You know, I hear this all the time, but he's made me a better writer. The books are better because of him. And as I think you know, I'm sure you know, there are certain writers who kvetch and complain bitterly about being edited. Like, oh, they're changing my words. And I come out of the newspaper world, so I really want to be edited. So Keith is great. He makes the books better. And not every writer gets to say that. But so I really want to credit where credit is due. He improves the product.
Well, I've known many of his authors, and I think generally that is their attitude. Bruce Borges is one of his new authors. Yes. Was here last week with a book called The Bitter End, and he too talked about, you know, Keith and the value of his editing. I think it's Keith was a bookseller before he became an editor in New York, and I think that he still sort of stays in touch with what he thinks readers want, that was honed by his time in bookselling. You know, I'm hoping that he will never retire. We're going to have drinks in San Diego at the mystery convention, and I'm hoping that he won't consider taking, you know, one of the buyouts that seem to be prevalent in New York publishing at the moment. But we had good news today, or at least I think it's good news, that Simon & Schuster was sold outside of publishing to a financial firm. And one of the things, and I'm thinking this might really be sort of revolutionary, one of the things this outfit does, what they call KKR, I think, is that they give employees a stake in the company. And, you know, I think that's a really nice thing to do. It's an incentivizing thing to do.
Yes. The saga of Simon & Schuster has gone on way too long. We needed this thing to end eventually.
Didn't want it to become part of another publishing company. I think, you know, if you look at, with all of its ups and downs, I think that Barnes & Noble really benefited from having a hedge fund, not another bookseller, buy it. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether having a financial firm, because so much of publishing makes no financial sense whatsoever. It really doesn't. I've spent 33 and a half, almost 34 years, 34 years in October being amazed. I never even intended to be a bookseller. When I sort of started as a little hobby, I thought, I don't have any real qualifications for this. I mean, I'm a librarian and I've studied the law, but I don't really know anything about running a bookstore. And it turned out that was a really good thing because I was untrammeled by, things I should know. And I just marveled at, the sorts of decisions and things that were going around me in the whole book world. And so I thought, it's like irresistible. It was like a salmon rising to a fly. It's just like, here I am. Right. I still am. But I do think that having an actual financial firm in charge of a big public number three publishing size with a very dynamic CEO. I'm very fond of Jonathan Karp. I've known him for forever. Yeah. I think that it may in some ways really change the way other publishing companies operate, if indeed this turns out to be a successful partnership, which it ought to be. It's helped by the fact that Simon Schuster was making money and has been profitable, so it's not like they're being rescued, from some financial abyss. I still don't understand why Paramount wants to sell it. I find that one of the most baffling corporate decisions I can come up with. But why would you give away a company that was actually in your portfolio making money, self-managing, and producing content that you could use?
I think that none of the old market for television/movies, it would all got upended, and I don't understand any of it any longer. But the things that used to make money don't anymore, and the things that didn't now do. And it's part of the reason why we see this two-ended strike with writers and actors, is the entire market is changing, and I don't understand it in the slightest. Your question is a great one. I don't know that anybody has the answer.
Well, I don't know either, but I'm really excited to see how this will go, we'll go for. I can't imagine the Justice Department stepping into this one because I don't think there are any, but I really think there needs to be a new design, and and I'll be very interested to see how this works out. And it seems to me that a financial firm is ideally placed, to really look at how this business is run and figure it out. So we'll find out. But in all things where creatives are involved, you can't really reduce it. It's not like a tech firm. You can't really reduce it entirely to financial sense or dollars and whatever it is, because I take gambles all the time, and people will say to me, why did you buy that, or why did you whatever it is? And the basic answer is I liked it, which is a terrible basis for a business decision. You have to really have guts. And you have to hope it works out, but that isn't a great real world strategy. But that's an editor strategy. If I ask Keith, why did you do this? His answer would be in part because he liked it.
Yes.
Right. Yes. I mean, he would think there was a market for it and all the rest of it. But at the core, he liked it, or he wouldn't, have put all this energy into it. Are you there, Keith? Feel free to make a comment.
He also likes certain writers too. He'll say, I'm not sure this is going to work, but I sure like that person. I'm going to invest.
Oh, sorry. One second. I'll mute this.
I'm not sure what happened there.
Okay, now I'm unmuted. Sorry, I didn't want you all to have your ears split by the joy of the puppies coming home and racing across the house. So we'll see how that goes. They might come in to visit us. Anyway, I can see that you were having a really great time with this book. And, not to dwell on the past, but James Byrne was originally known to me as another author, and it didn't always produce joy for him. And I'm very glad that you have a second act that you are enjoying so much.
I am indeed, so much so. I'm having a great deal of fun with this book. I'm having a great deal of fun being back with Keith. I've got Dana Kay as my publicist. Janet Reed is my literary agent. And so I feel like I'm surrounded by super talented people, and I'm having a blast.
I can see that. And, you know, through Des, you get to have all kinds of really wonderful adventures. You know, I mean, I love the idea that you've got a kind of footloose character who can, in fact, go different places, penetrate different kinds of bad guys. You don't always have to have them up against, you know, the same sort of bad actors. Well, I mean, to write a thriller, you have to have bad actors. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to be a thriller, right? And actually, thrillers do rise and fall, I think, to a great degree, maybe even more than the hero, on the bad actor. So are you finding that you're enjoying crafting, you know, I mean, Des is great and you've got him down. But so is the real joy for you going forward likely to lie more in crafting your villains?
Sure. Yeah, Des is a high bar because he's a very talented fellow. He's physically talented. He's physically fit. And he's also well-educated. He's got a background in engineering and in computers. So to find a villain that in which the power imbalance is in the right way means I have to get really creative. He's not going to go up against a guy knocking over a 7-Eleven as a main prop. That would be the power imbalance would be the wrong direction. The book would be over really quickly. So knowing that Des is as talented as he is, I have to start by saying, okay, I need a threat worthy of Des. And that is exactly as you point out, the beginning. One of the very first questions I ask myself is, how can I come up with a threat that will make him sweat?
Absolutely. Given his background and his superior skills, you know, it has to be somebody really remarkable, something. So it is going to be a test for you. So far, you've had not so much a single villain, but kind of a conglomerate bad actor thing. Do you see yourself, you know, having a bad guy, or is it probably always going to be a group?
I think it's probably going to be a group. And then here's why I say that. The third book is written and it's in Keith's hands. And in this one, it's not the same vast conspiracy the first two books entailed, but it is a conspiracy and it's more than one person involved. And I'm not going to give away anything, but I was able to come up with a primary villain that I really had a tremendous amount of fun writing. And since Des is fun, I found somebody who's a bad guy who is equally fun to write. So I found myself just having a heck of a good time with this story.
But you know, the fact you're having such a good time really comes off when I'm reading it. You know, I can just see you kind of, you know, rollicking along. And of course I know you, but I think any reader would come away with that, you know, that feeling of, despite the bad things going on, that real feeling of enjoyment.
And yeah, that was fun. The thing I really wanted to try was a lighter spirited, really terrible, awful things happening, but to tell it in a guy who thinks he's super duper funny and sometimes is not nearly as funny as he really is, a guy who thinks he's just lucky, this bloke in the whole world, kind of traipsing along with a smile in his heart. He's got that incredibly dopey, over the top name, Desmond Aloysius.
I have to ask you, where did the name come from? I think Des, D-E-Z, is a wonderful short, you know, thing to call him, but Desmond Aloysius Limerick is so Irish.
It is so weird and so dumb and so goofy. I wanted a name that I hadn't seen in any other action adventure, and I didn't want a Jack or a Jake or a Nick because we run into them with some commonality. So I really wanted to be nice and short. And I like the Z at the end of the name. It's a punchy word. And so that led me to Desmond. And then Limerick, I liked the word because I'm Irish American myself, and it's a, you know, city in Ireland. And we think of it as a dopey, silly, bad poem too. So it's already got kind of a childish or like thing to it. So it's Irish and it's jovial and trivial. And then Aloysius is just one of those names you always think, that's the dopiest name in the world. Why would anybody name their child that? So I came up with Des, which led me to Desmond. I came up with Limerick, and then Aloysius was the goofy icing on top of a goofy cake. And I thought it would be really fun to have a big, tough action adventure star with a just dopey name. That would be a lot of fun.
Well, no, I can see that. I mean, it clearly is Irish, but I do think Des, D-E-Z, is a wonderful, wonderful short name, because you're right, these action heroes do have short names, right?
Right.
Yeah, Reacher's two syllable, but not everybody is even two syllable when you really think about it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, no, it's all great. So why don't we call Ian up and see if anybody, well, I'm not sure whether we're actually live or not due to the weird sound thing that we had going on. Ian, are we actually live or are we just recording this?
I was able to get us back onto Facebook.
Aha, attaboy.
We lost YouTube, unfortunately. One of the viewers said they wouldn't mind seeing the puppies, Barbara.
Oh, well, they're currently outside, but Scooter's just back from the groomer, so let me see when he comes in if I can corral him, but I can't really get up without leaving the screen here, so maybe it won't work out. Tell them to try at 5:30 and I'll see if I can capture him when we talk to Adrian McKinney, because we're going to segue from, actually, we're still being Irish. We're going from you to Adrian McKinney and what he calls the last case for Sean Duffy's last case. Is it? Right. All right. So any questions?
Actually,
you can come back on screen. You're just a weird thing at the moment. There you are.
There we go. Yes. Who or what inspired you to become a writer?
Oh, my father was a big, big fan of action books when I was growing up. He loved The Four Feathers and Beau Gest and stories like that. And so he really introduced me to kind of rollicking adventure type of stories. Then from a middle school, junior high age on, I was a comic book collector. And I really, to this day, by the way, I still read comic books. And a lot of what I learned about telling a good rollicking story, I learned from the great, great writers of the late 60s, mid 70s, who worked in the Marvel universe, taught me a great deal about it. Third, I had in high school and in college, and then after college, I was in amateur theater. I did a lot of theater, and it really taught me to think in a three-act structure, act one, act two, act three, with, you know, inciting incidents at act one and act two. And so once I had this background of loving those books from my dad and loving action adventure as a comic book guy, and then I had a pretty good understanding of the three-act structure. So while I was still a college student, I attempted to write a book. And as luck would have it, Kate Misiak at Bantam purchased that book, a name that longtime fans of Mysteries will remember. And that got me launched. But it was because a little bit of my father and a little bit of my own love of two different genres.
Your early books were very successful.
I remember
how much I loved. What's the name of the first one?
It was Bishop's Gambit Declined.
That's it, right? They were wonderful fun. Came out when, in the 90s?
1987 was the first one.
Okay.
Bantam needed some of their own writers. They only had reprint writers, and so they picked up about a dozen of people. I was one of them. Robert Cray was one of them. And a woman named Sue Grafton, who you may remember that name, was one of them. Two of those people went on to stay with Bantam for a long period of time. I was not one of those. But that was Kate Misiak had a very good eye for talent. And she did.
She and Suzanne Kirk were remarkable. Yeah. Right. And Sarah Ann Freed, bless her heart, were remarkable editors. I opened the store in 1989, and so I wasn't there for your first book, but I remember your early work and how much we all liked it. That was also an era when authors could be introduced in paperbacks, you know. And so, like, for example, The Monkey's Raincoat, the first Robert Crais, not Joe Pike, but Elvis Cole was a paperback original. Mm-hmm. And that gave them a little more scope because there was less risk, you know, involved in the publishing process. That form has largely gone away, not entirely, but for various reasons. But I am noticing that there is more original publishing being done in the large paperback format.
So, yes.
You know, so it hasn't entirely disappeared. Sorry, Ian, carry on. Any more?
Yes. What is your daily writing process? Are you a plotter or a pantser?
I am very much a pantser. And my daily writing process is best described as stupid. What I do is I write longhand in a steno pad in the mornings, and then I go and do my day job. And in the evening, I take whatever I wrote in the morning and I translate it into my computer. So in the morning, I use my creative side of my brain, and in the evening, I use the analytical side of my brain. And I can see before the sun sets, yes, what I wrote this morning went really, really well. It carried the freight it needed to for plot, for character, for to tell a joke, to set up a reveal, whatever. Or I can say, no, that was terrible. That didn't do any good at all. I was wasting time. Nix it. Get rid of it. And because I'm able to analyze what I do every day, it makes me a really fast writer. And I can get through the first draft of a book in about 3 months. But it's because I'm writing, analyzing all the time. So that system works for me. And I usually know kind of the inciting incident in Act One that kicks the jump starts the plot. I know the inciting incident in Act Two that really turns the plot on its head, but I never know where they're going to end. And I often will write 30 or 40 pages and think, yeah, you know, I didn't like those last 30. I'm going to erase them and start over again. And there are a whole bunch of writers I know would have an aneurysm if they lost 30 pages of a manuscript, but it's my system.
Yeah, but I think that's a risk that pantsers take.
Uh-huh.
You know, is that it may not always work, and then you may have to back up and reformulate.
And I get surprised. I will suddenly say, oh my gosh, I did not see that coming. And that in many ways feels like the most organic writing. For me, it works.
And finally, what are the top three books on your to-be-read list?
Oh my gosh. Well, I am so excited to find out that Meg Gardner has another in the Unsub series. Yeah. She took some time off, as many of your listeners will know, in order to write Heat 2 with Michael Mann, which was the sequel to the famous movie. Heat 2, in my mind, was an absolutely tremendous novel, and I gobbled it up. But I also wanted to get back to the Unsub series, Caitlin Hendricks. I think that's the character's name, which I think is a great, great series. I'm very excited about that. Secondly, Lou Burney hasn't had a new book out for a little while. Lou Burney has a book coming up.
He does. And we're going to be talking to him, I'm here to tell you right now, on September 18th.
And he and I are going to be on a panel together in VoucherCon. I get to moderate a panel.
Oh, good. Well, I will see you there for that.
I'm going to try not to fanboy him because I'm nuts about his writing. I think he's absolutely just tremendous. And then there's some other writers I just keep on the back burner because I think they've never written a bad book. And Robert Cray is certainly one of them. And a couple other folks who just every time they write a book, I think it's T. Jefferson Parker. Don't think you could write a bad book if you wanted to. So there's a whole bunch of I just keep waiting to see. And another, there's a Spanish writer named Arturo Perez Reverta who hasn't written a new book in quite a long time.
First book of his was absolutely he wrote a real biblio mystery, the name of which is escaping me, but absolutely brilliant book.
Really?
You're right. It's been a very long time. Well, I will recommend to you a new book by Nina Simon called Mother-Daughter Murder Night, which I think you will really like. And then you should read Keith's author, Bruce Borgos, The Bitter Past, which is a really, I rarely say this, but it is an original plot.
I love it.
You hardly ever really run into one, but it really is. Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
I liked it. I really liked it. And I'm pleased to see that he has another book coming too. So that's really good news. Well, Ian, thank you. I'm glad you got us on Facebook, and we will post it on YouTube. We just have to do a little recording work. So always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm pleased to see or to know that I'll see you in San Diego. That's very exciting.
Yep, very exciting. And I sure appreciate the opportunity to be here. Ian, I appreciate the tech miracles that you pull off. I don't know how you do it, but you're a genius.
My pleasure.
I have no idea how he does it either. And you know what? Maybe for the third book, you could come and see us.
Oh, I would love that.
We have done this by Zoom twice. And I'm going to point out to your publisher that third time deserves an actual live appearance.
I would love that beyond words. I'll second that motion.
Actually, I'm beginning to think maybe what we'll do is we'll have a group of Keith authors. Maybe we'll have like a Keith Kayla night. Because he likes to come. And we could do that, and he could be there. And yeah, I'll think about that.
Love the question.
I think that's a great idea. Meantime, thank you all very much for joining us. And let me wish you a very pleasant evening and remind you that we do have autographed copies of Deadlock, and it's not too late to just buy The Gatekeeper, which is now out in paperback. And I think you can read Deadlock all by itself, but since there's only one book in front of it, I would recommend that you read The Gatekeeper and then read Deadlock. Bye. Sure. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.